This is tape number one, side number two of Love, Marriage, and Sex.
When you say, I do, to these promises, you are committing yourself to a lifetime together. Matthew 19:4-9. Marriage was established by God at creation and pictures God's relationship with Israel. Isaiah 54:5, Ezekiel 16:8. It also depicts the spiritual relationship between Jesus Christ and the church. Ephesians 5:21-33, Revelation 19:7-9. So be sure you know what is involved when you say, I do, on your wedding day. And be sure you intend to live up to the responsibilities of this godly institution. With the words, by the authority of Jesus Christ, I now pronounce you husband and wife, may you two become one and truly live happily ever after. 5 ways to love your mate. What is the quotient of love in your marriage? Stop and think about it. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much love are you giving in your marriage? Are you a 3, maybe a 6, perhaps a rare 10? You know you have an IQ, intelligence quotient, but did you realize that, bear with me for the sake of argument, each husband and wife has an LQ, love quotient? God commands married couples to love one another and to increase their LQ. God inspired the Apostle Paul to instruct, husbands, love your wives, Ephesians 5:25. Paul also taught that wives should love their husbands, Titus 2:4. God created marriage to be the most joyous, love-filled relationship. Unfortunately, many husbands and wives are not actively loving one another. Their LQ is dangerously low. They endure loveless marriages of misery. God wants husbands and wives to be lovers. Here are 5 ways to show true love for your mate. The first 2 ways deal with the aspect of commitment in marriage. They will solidify your marriage and place it on a firm foundation. The last 3 ways deal with the pleasure phase of marriage. God wants your marriage to be brimful and running over with real, deep joy. Lovers forever. The first way to love your mate is with the love expressed by the Greek word agape. This is the word translated in 1 Corinthians 13 as love, or in the authorized version, charity. Agape means unconditional, unselfish giving. In marriage, agape could be defined as a willful commitment to give to your imperfect mate without expecting to get in return. You consciously, under all circumstances, make a lifelong commitment to never stop giving to your mate. God is the rock from which agape flows. He is the source of the force that will give you the power to overcome all obstacles in your marriage. Your union must begin with God. The Apostle John wrote, and truly our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ, 1 John 1:3. The joy of agape will be added to your marriage if you first fellowship with God through Bible study, prayer, and obedience to God's commandments. You will gain access to agape through God's Holy Spirit, Romans 5:5. God will be at the center of your marriage, giving it strength. God plus husband plus wife equal one agape-filled marriage. This is the missing formula for success in so many marriages. As you submit to God's laws concerning marriage and other human relationships, He will unleash the power of agape to you, which helps you to willfully choose to love your mate. Society presents the false and damaging picture of love controlling you. In this false picture, love captures and enslaves you. You are a helpless prisoner of love, unable to control your feelings. Have you heard married people say, I cannot love him anymore, the feeling is gone? In truth, you choose to love or not to love. Agape is not a feeling, but a conscious and willful act you control. God commands us to love one another because He knows we can control love, 2 John 5. Follow through on your decision to love your mate by committing yourself to give the love that never fails, 1 Corinthians 13:8, New American Bible. Commitment produces endurance. You should have promised in a covenant with God on your wedding day to love your mate unto death. Pray daily to God for the power to love your mate and to keep that commitment in your mind constantly. Determined to allow nothing or no one, including yourself, to stop you from loving your mate. Go to God and recommit yourself to loving your mate. Since agape is a willful commitment to give, your will and commitment must be followed by action. You cannot get love, you can only give it. Regardless of how little you receive, you will always have love in your marriage because the quantity and quality of love is dependent on how much you give. In an emergency, you would not hesitate to sacrifice your life to save your mate. Are you willing to sacrifice your life daily by pushing aside your needs and wants to satisfy your mate, by putting your mate's needs ahead of your own? When you are tired, do you get up and serve instead of waiting to be served? Don't give to get. The Apostle Paul admonished Christians, "Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others." Philippians 2, verses 3 and 4. Strive to reach the state where fulfilling your mate's needs becomes, next to your commitment to God, the predominant need of your life. Give, and you will have agape. You may be saying, "But my mate doesn't deserve special love." But agape motivates one to give to an imperfect person, yes, even to an undeserving person. Agape, unconditional, unselfish love, does not require the other person to change or be perfect. There are no conditions, no qualifications for the giving of agape. Jesus Christ, the perfect husband and the only human who ever perfectly expressed agape, gave his life for us while we were yet sinners. Ephesians 5:25, Romans 5:8. Christ did not require us to change first. His love was unconditional. We ought to follow Christ's perfect example of love. Demand of yourself to give to your mate even when you have been wronged. By giving, in spite of your mate's shortcomings, you will feel more positive toward your spouse. Peter expressed the principle in 1 Peter 4:8. Above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins. Your unconditional love may cause a positive response in your mate, although this should never be the motive for giving. 1 Peter 3, verses 1 and 2. Do not become disappointed. It is easy to become disillusioned after giving and giving without any response, not even a thank you. Agape does not require love in return. Love does not give in order to get. The Apostle Paul taught that if we give with expectations of getting in return, our love is vain. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. 1 Corinthians 13:3. Remove expectation, and then love will fill your heart, leaving no room for disappointment. Jesus Christ taught that the joy is in the giving. It is more blessed to give than to receive. Acts 20:35. And yet, at the same time, you can take heart from God's promise that if you faithfully and unselfishly give, you will eventually be rewarded. Give, and it will be given to you, good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over. For with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. Luke 6:38. Agape is the most powerful facet of the whole of love. Agape will carry your marriage through the most difficult trials. Lovers belong to each other. The second way to love your mate is with the love of belonging, which will bring you and your mate closer together. This love will add another point to your LQ and enrich your marriage. God created marriage to be the closest human relationship. Yet, many married couples live together as strangers. A cold curtain of loneliness divides them as they go their separate ways. What about your marriage? Do you live under the same roof, but as strangers to one another? God did not intend husbands and wives to live together like total strangers. He has a solution to your problem. What is the love of belonging? This love is characterized by a bond of unity, companionship, and loyal devotion. The love of belonging shines brightest in older couples. They act alike and think alike. They have become one. The love of belonging is not just for older couples, but for all couples. God created man with the need to belong. God looked at all he had made and saw that it was very good. Genesis 1:31. But when God looked at Adam, he saw something that was not good. And the Lord God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him an help, meet for him." Genesis 2:18, Authorized Version. Adam was lonely. God prescribed the love of belonging to cure Adam's problem. God gave Adam a woman, Eve, to love. Through giving, the first married couple could have grown to belong to one another. This need to belong cannot be satisfied through any other person, whether mother, father, sister, or brother, only through your mate. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Verse 24. As with agape, you can only give the love of belonging to your mate. Accept your mate the way your mate is, not the way you would like him or her to be. Your mate will not feel he or she belongs as long as he or she senses you are not satisfied with him or her. Emphasize the positive things about your mate. Make a list of all the good things. Think back to the time when you were engaged and of all the qualities you admired. You might be surprised to find those same qualities in your spouse today. Constantly think on these good qualities. Look to find more admirable qualities. The love of belonging is making your mate feel accepted. Learn to empathize with your mate. Push out your concerns and concentrate on the concerns of your mate. Seek total identification with your husband or wife. Immerse yourself in your mate's concerns, feel your mate's hurts, experience his or her frustrations, sing your mate's joys. Cleave to each other. The Apostle Paul encourages us to bear, take upon ourselves, one another's burdens, Galatians 6:2. You will become an emotional refuge for your mate, a hiding place where your mate can find warmth and shelter from the storms of life. Both of you will have a home in each other's hearts. Your mate will have a place to belong, and the love of belonging will bring you closer together. In Genesis 2:24, authorized version, God tells married couples to cleave to each other. The word cleave was translated from the Hebrew verb dabak, which has the root meaning to solder or to weld together. The strongest welding technique is called brazing, two pieces of metal welded together under intense heat. The molecules of the two metals become inseparable. God compares the trials of life to a fire, 1 Peter 1:7. By cleaving to one another as you go through life's challenges, you will become one flesh, Genesis 2:24. Becoming one physically, mentally, and spiritually should be the goal of every married couple. In the Song of Solomon, the Shulamite bride expressed the love of belonging she shared with her mate when she said, "I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine." Song of Solomon 6:3. Agape love and the love of belonging are the two legs upon which your marriage stands. They are the foundations upon which the next three loves are built. Use these two loves to increase your LQ, your love quotient, and make your marriage unshakable. There are three additional ways to love your mate and increase your LQ. This phase of marriage could be called the pleasure phase. Let's look at these three ways. Lovers cherish each other. The Greek word phileo describes the love of cherishing. This word is used in the New Testament to designate brotherly love, fondness, affection, and cherishing. This is the third way to love your mate. The Apostle Paul clearly described phileo when he wrote, "Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor giving preference to one another." Romans 12:10. Cherish is the word we will use to describe phileo. Cherish means to value highly, to hold in high esteem. Physically, your mate should be the most valuable person in your life, and spiritually, the most valuable after God. You treat things of value with lots of attention and tender loving care. If you do that with inanimate objects, shouldn't your mate receive even more cherishing? As with all the forms of true love, you cannot get phileo. You receive love as you give love. You can cherish your mate. Here is how. Cherishing is sharing. In Romans 12:10, Paul described the love of cherishing as brotherly love. Brothers share. In biblical times, married couples affectionately referred to each other as sister or brother. Song of Solomon 4:10 and 8:1. How much sharing do you do with your mate? Do you share more with friends than with your own wife or husband? Your whole life should be shared together in a pleasurable way. Sharing is doing things together. Invite your mate to share a hobby. Together, you could collect stamps, refinish old furniture, exercise, or pursue any number of enjoyable hobbies and projects. The main objective is that you have fun while sharing together. Sharing is communicating with your mate. Wives often complain, "My husband doesn't talk to me." While husbands lament, all she does is nag. Such statements are signs that neither partner is communicating effectively. Effective communication does not start with either listening or speaking. Surprised? Perhaps you thought it was all in listening and speaking. True communication, like true love, starts with giving, outgoing concern. You must seek to understand. This is the give way, rather than to be understood, the get way. The emphasis should be placed on your giving. Seek to understand what your mate wants to share rather than to get your mate to understand you. This approach to communication will open many new opportunities for sharing. Cherishing is touching. How often during the day do you touch your mate? Only at bedtime? Could you and your husband or wife be called the untouchables? If this is the case, your marriage is missing a great deal of joy. Couples often touch too much when they are dating, but appear to be handcuffed after they marry. Lovers love to touch. It sends the message, I love you. It tells your mate, you're important to me. I cherish you. The lack of touching conveys the exact opposite meaning. Reach out and touch your mate. Weave touching into the daily fabric of your life. Give your mate a warm hug in the morning. Sit close together at home or in the car. Reach over and lovingly hold hands. Think about times you can touch your mate. Then touch to your mate's pleasure. King Midas' touch turned everything to gold, but the loving touch turns everything to love. Give your mate a touch, and you will give Philio the love of cherishing. Lovers are romantic. Eros is the word used in Greek literature to describe romantic love. It is the love about which ballads and poems are written. Eros is the love that can light up your marriage and take it from boring black and white silence to Technicolor 3D 50mm excitement in Dolby sound. Here, then, is the fourth major area in loving your mate. You may be thinking, romance is just a Hollywood production. Surely God doesn't want us involved with that mushy stuff. Well, here's news for you. Good news for your marriage. Eros, romance, is real. God inspired a whole book of the Bible, the Song of Solomon, to describe the proper kind of romantic love in marriage. The Bible also describes the love Jacob had for Rachel. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed but a few days to him because of the love he had for her. Genesis 29:20. Only romantic love could make 7 years seem like a few days. Jacob was euphoric on cloud nine. He was high on Eros. Yes, romantic love is real, and you really need to give it to your mate. In many cases, wives have little trouble understanding Eros. Quite often, they are starving for romance. Husbands tend to ignore romance and do not fulfill their wives' needs. Wives desire romance. Romance must come before sex. God wants you to give the pleasure of romantic love to your mate. Are you a fighter or a lover? If you have not been giving romantic love, you probably have been fighting. Now is the time to become a lover, not a fighter. There are three keys to developing romantic love: climate, imagination, and surrender. The climate for romantic love. The climate in which romance is given is important. Eros is emotional and sensitive and requires a warm climate to flourish. Project a warm, positive attitude towards your mate. Ask God to help you remove any negative feelings you may have had in the past. Ephesians 4, verses 31 and 32. You are making a new beginning in your relationship. Your giving of kindness will go a long way in producing a warm climate for romance. Decor, a lover's grooming, is an important part of the romantic climate. Since Eros is sensitive to sight and scent, your grooming, or the lack of it, can turn your mate on or off. Be clean. If you want to get next to your mate, make sure you're tidy. Wives, keep your hair neat and pretty. Husbands, shave those whiskers. It is difficult to go cheek to cheek with a cactus. Exercise personal hygiene and also use a little cologne or perfume to spice things up. Dress neatly, even around the house. Wives, dress as appealingly as possible for your husbands. Husbands, dress to please your wives. Find out what your mate likes to see you in, then aim to please. The look of love produces a romantic climate. Solomon spoke of the power of romantic eye contact when he wrote, "You have made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eyes." Song of Solomon 4:9, New American Standard Bible. Couples who are in love look at one another often. It has been said that the eye is the mirror of the soul. It is also true that the eye is the mirror of love. Create a romantic climate with your mate through eye contact. Look warmly into your mate's eyes when you talk. In public situations, occasionally look for your mate, catch his or her eye, and smile or wink. You will be sending the message, "I love you," from your eyes to your mate's heart. Nothing warms the romantic climate like the giving of affection. Our generation has been stripped of its natural affection, 2 Timothy 3:3, Authorized Version. We have become cold and aloof, even in our marriages. Take your marriage out of the ice age by giving warm affection to your mate. Kissing has always been a symbol of affection and warmth. You should make kissing the official form of greeting your mate. A kiss in the morning is a pleasant way to start the day. Kisses through the day are an excellent way to sustain your mate's affection. Solomon's bride desired his kisses. "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine," Song of Solomon 1:2. As wine makes the heart merry, so do the kisses of romantic love. Little things mean a lot. In no other area of marriage can so little mean so much as in romance. Have you stopped doing the little things? Now is the time to start anew. Use imagination. Romance is all in the mind. The imaginings of your mind can be a powerful tool in becoming more romantic toward your mate. Solomon said, "We are what we think," Proverbs 23:7. If you think romantically, you will act romantically. Jesus Christ, of course, spoke of the sinful effects on the mind that lusting after a person who is not your mate will have, Matthew 5:28. But have you ever thought about the other side of the scripture? Usually, for every good there is evil, and for every evil there is good. It is obviously wrong to have lustful thoughts about someone else's mate, but it is good to have thoughts of desire toward your own mate. God told Eve that her desire would be toward her husband, and the same applied to Adam, Genesis 3:16. Solomon instructs us to use our minds in this way. Drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own well. As a loving deer and a graceful doe, let her breath satisfy you at all times, and always be enraptured with her love, Proverbs 5, verses 15 and 19. Even when your mate is out of sight, never let him or her be out of mind. Use your heart and imagination to create positive, pleasing thoughts about your mate, Philippians 4:8. Think about your mate's attractive qualities. Hear his or her warm and reassuring voice. See that beautiful smile. Take mental stock of your mate's inner and outer beauty. Proverbs 29:18, Authorized Version, says, "Where there is no vision, the people perish." We can also say that where there is no vision, there is no romance. Launch yourself into the future through your imagination. Think about how you will be romantic with your mate when you are together again. Visualize warm and thrilling romantic situations where you are actively giving love to your mate. If you use your mind and imagination, your thoughts will reinforce your feelings and actions of romantic love. Surrender. Surrender is another key to developing romantic love. You must surrender and give this type of love to your mate. We have seen that Eros, romantic love, is real, and the need for it to be revived in your marriage has been made clear. You have been equipped with the principles and applications of romantic love. Now it is up to you. Do not grieve the spirit of Eros. Do not withhold the romantic love your mate so desperately needs from you. Add another point to your LQ. Surrender and let love flow. Lovers are lovers. The fifth way to love your mate is with sexual love. How is your love life? God intended it to be pleasurable. You and your mate have the capacity to reach that high level of sexual enjoyment. Even if your sex life has been unfulfilling, you can change it for the better. The place to start improving your sex life is with the application and giving of the other four loves. Sexual love has been placed last in this series of points because its success is dependent on the other areas. If you are to improve your sex life, first improve the rest of your marriage. The prudish Victorian approach to sex as being one of the necessary evils of life is wrong. The modern new morality is also wrong. To properly give sexual love to your mate, you need God's positive attitude toward sex. God created sex, and he says that it is good in marriage. Genesis 1, verses 27, 28, and 31. God inspired Paul to write, "Marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers God will judge." Hebrews 13, 4. For bed, Paul used the Greek word koite, which literally means cohabitation or coitus. The translators of the Authorized Version of the Bible were ashamed to use the word coitus, so they used bed, and the Revised Authorized Version perpetuates this translation. But God is not ashamed of this beautiful act of love. Neither were Adam and Eve before Satan got to them in the Garden of Eden, Genesis 2:25. You have a God-given responsibility to give sexual love and satisfaction to your mate. God commands husbands and wives to satisfy one another's sexual needs. Let the husband fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. 1 Corinthians 7:3, NASB. Your body actually belongs to your mate, and your mate's body is yours. Verse 4. With that authority comes the responsibility to take care of your mate's body as if it were your own. Ephesians 5:28. Never abuse your mate's body. Handle it with tender, loving care. You should never refuse to give sexual love to your mate or use it as a weapon or for leverage. 1 Corinthians 7:5. What is your LQ? After studying these five ways to love your mate, your love quotient should be 5 points higher. Increase your love quotient. If you give these loves, your marriage will become more contented and pleasurable. Finally, listen to God's admonishment. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life which he has given you under the sun. For that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Ecclesiastes 9:9, RAV. The greatest gift you can give your children is not money, power, or prestige, though every parent has it. Too many never give it. The birth of a child into a family is one of the greatest thrills of life. Young couples eagerly anticipate the day of arrival. Months of waiting and planning and dreaming and hoping culminate in the excitement of newborn life. Most parents already have a lifetime of plans for their newborns. They may plan for their children to be successful doctors or prominent lawyers, or plan a major league sports career for them. How many parents have already purchased, before the day of birth, a football, a piano, ice skates, or a baseball glove? Above all, we want them to have good health and be happy with whatever they become. Parenting is a full-time job. In addition to their long-range goals, parents hope to give their children every material benefit possible. How many times have you heard parents say, "Our child will never have to go through the hard times we did"? Most children today grow up with better homes, do less work, have more clothing, more leisure time, and more convenience items than any generation in history. In order to provide this plethora of material goods, parents must spend countless hours on their jobs. Many fathers have taken a second job in order to provide necessities and luxuries of life. Many mothers work outside the home so the family can afford more and better things than would otherwise be possible. It is a noble goal to provide well for the family and to give the children opportunities. But in pursuit of material possessions, many parents have failed to give the most important gift of all. Think about it. Proud parents bring new life into the world, tiny miniature reproductions of themselves. Your child will have your looks, your personality, many of your abilities, and your temperament. Most parents want your children to grow up to be chips off the old block. But too many couples today quickly lose their newfound zeal in the early months of their child's life. They just let their children grow up, too often left in daycare centers or with babysitters, seldom influenced by their parents. Then, when these children become teenagers, the parents wonder why they can't communicate with them, why there is a generation gap. What they fail to realize is that this generation gap has existed from birth. There never was any real communication. The problems may not be manifest, however, until teenage, from birth to school age. There is no more important time in life than the early years. Practically everything we will become is started and determined in those first few years of life. It has been said we learn more from birth to age one than we will learn in any other 1 year of our lives. It seems hard to believe, but researchers insist it is true. And we continue to learn in those early years at astounding rates. Little children are taking in everything, learning to walk, talk, and think. They are forming personality and character traits. How do they learn during those early years? By example. Everything you do or not do is being taken in. Your children will learn to speak with the same accent, voice tones, and vocabulary as you do. They will take on your personality traits and good habits. They probably will develop similar tastes in food, entertainment, and art. That is, if you're around to influence your children. Of course, if parents are not around, their children will pick up mannerisms, personalities, and tastes of others that might not always be desirable. If you shuffle them off to the daycare centers, or leave them with the babysitters, or leave them alone with the television set blaring from dawn to midnight, they'll be taking in quite a different perspective than you intend. And the best laid plans. Far too often, though new parents start out with the best of intentions, they quickly return to a previously established routine. Long hours of work and fighting the traffic may not make for the best parental attitude at the end of a tiring day. Dad may say, "Honey, get a babysitter and let's go out to dinner. I'm exhausted." When the weekend rolls around, the old routine of golf, tennis, fishing, bowling, or whatever recreation parents have participated in beckons. Dad may think he'll play ball with his son when he is older, but family habits usually are set in concrete and later hard to change. A youngster seeing Dad go off with others the first several years is not suddenly going to want to start kicking or throwing a ball around with Dad when he's about 12. If, on the other hand, parents have played with their children on the living room floor when they were 3 months old, then in the backyard when they were toddlers, taught them to ride bikes at age 4, played tag in the park when they were 8, then, when they are teenagers, they'll still be playing games together. Teaching by example. There is no greater opportunity to influence the way your child will turn out than by the example you set. You've all heard the old adage too many parents still live by, "Do what I say, not what I do." Surely we know that doesn't work. Parents who lament a child starting to smoke in junior high school have no recourse if they've continued to smoke themselves. The father who brags about how he cheated the government out of taxes due cannot expect his son to grow up an honest, law-abiding citizen. These parents have already lost the battle. Their examples speak louder than their words. In some cases, our examples counteract our words. There have been some alarming social trends in recent years. There are increasing numbers of alcoholic parents and parents who are abusive to their children. After analyzing hundreds of problems, psychologists have found in a large percentage of those cases where parents were abusive to children, they were themselves abused. Similar statistics apply to alcoholism. Adults who become alcoholic are often a product of a home where alcohol was abused. If you are a parent, you have a tremendous responsibility to set the proper example in your home. But in order to set an example, you have to be there. The objective is to have a positive effect. Homes that are filled with love and sharing will produce children who love and share. And when they grow up to become parents themselves, the same joys and happiness will usually be present in their homes. Qualifications for parenting. What are the qualifications of a parent? What kind of skills are required for the most important responsibility anyone can ever take, to become a mother or father? What kind of schooling is mandatory for having a baby? And what certificate is issued to demonstrate proficiency in parenting? To become a parent, all you have to do is reach the age of puberty. That's it. I'm sure we will all admit such a person is by no means qualified to become a parent in his or her early teens, but it is biologically possible. The question then is, when is one qualified to become a proper parent? Obtaining an education, gaining skills for a profession, growing in maturity to face the responsibility that accompany parenthood ought to be required. But who can enforce the requirements? There are no legislative or judicial bodies to make laws and enforce them. So young people grow up in whatever environment their own parents have created for them. They learn by example what parenting is all about. And the result is the society in which you live. The biblical examples. From the pages of the Bible, we learn it was much the same in the society of ancient Israel. In that nation, there was a priest who served well in God's service. His name was Eli. But Eli was not effective in child-rearing. Of his children, God says, "Now the sons of Eli were sons of Belial, they knew not the Lord, 1 Samuel 2:12. It was a responsibility of the priests to offer sacrifices for the people. The sons of Eli abused the sacrificial ceremony. Wherefore the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for men abhorred the offering of the Lord, 17. In addition, the sons of Eli were sexually immoral. They brought great disrespect upon their father and the way of God. It was a shame these young men could not continue in the footsteps of their father as they should have. But Eli made the tragic mistake so many parents do. He did not properly rear his children and train them. He was too busy, even in the service of God. The results were disastrous. God then selected Samuel to follow Eli in priestly service. Surely you would think Samuel would have learned the lesson from Eli, how to become a proper father and rear respectful children. But alas, the sad story was repeated. Samuel married and had a family. It was normal for him to desire his sons to follow in his steps as priests and judges in Israel. The story is told in 1 Samuel 8. And it came to pass, when Samuel was old, that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of the firstborn was Joel, and the name of the second, Abiah. They were judges in Beersheba, 1-2. But as Eli before him, Samuel did not influence and teach them by his good example. The result? And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre, money, and took bribes and perverted judgment, 3. The reputation of the sons of Samuel was so bad in the community that the people demanded a change in government. What a tragedy. Let these examples serve you well if you are parents or plan to be parents. What is that gift? What is then the nearest thing to the magic formula of child rearing? Be prepared. The answer may surprise you. I promise it will not cost any money and it will not be complicated. The most important gift you will ever give your child is your time. If you can't take the time to be a parent, don't become one. Parents who take the time to rear children properly will receive no greater thrills, joys, and rewards in this life. But if they don't apply the right principles and don't take the proper time, there are no greater sorrows and disappointments than improperly reared children. If you are a parent, you are a constant living example to your children. They are learning every minute of every day how to be and how not to be. They will see your positive examples. They will also see your negative examples. If your children see you fight, scream, and have disrespect for one another, they will think that's the way husbands and wives are. After all, it's all they've ever seen. Newborn babies don't have instinct. Animals do. A newborn calf or colt knows right where to go for dinner. It will be up and walking within minutes because instinct has been built into its mind. Everything human babies learn must be taught. By word, by example. They learn the meaning of love, caring, concern, warmth. They learn how to smile, giggle, laugh, and cry. They can also learn anger, hostility, disrespect. They are constantly learning. There is no better way for them to learn how to be the right kind of parent themselves than by the proper examples you set for them. But you have to spend time with them to teach by example. You only have one chance. If you have small children, spend all the time you can with them, showing them positive examples of the right way to live. The years will quickly go by. Children who are toddlers today, tomorrow will be graduating from high school. The first thing you know, you will be concerned about college and marriage, and you'll wonder where the years went. How many families have had to learn that working long hours, advancing in position, or earning more money can produce one of the least desirable fruits of all, the loss of one's own children? So what if parents become prominent surgeons, successful attorneys, respected professors, or corporation presidents? If along the way they lose their children, maybe their marriage and perhaps their health, what has been gained? We all desire to work hard and obtain the best for our children, but if reaching the top of the corporate ladder means sacrificing children and family, it just isn't worth it. There are no magic formulas, and successful child rearing will require old-fashioned hard work. But if you want to know the greatest gift you can ever give your child, it is your time. Begin now to give that precious gift to your children. Confessions of a Busy Father. Who are the most important people in your life? Why, my family, of course, you'd probably answer. I would die for them. That was my answer, too, but then I discovered that I was not dying for them, but killing them slowly through neglect. Through an event I'll never forget, God helped me learn that a father should never be too busy for his family. The agony. It was the usual Tuesday morning with phone calls to make and appointments to keep. Then my wife reminded me that today was my daughter's big track meet, the final one of the season. "Oh, no," I said. "I've been so busy I forgot all about it. I have business today. I can't go." I reluctantly walked downstairs to break the news to my daughter. By the look in my eye, she knew what I was going to say. Her eyes began to water. I apologized for forgetting and encouraged her to do her best. I told her I would pray for her. The trouble was, I was the one who needed prayer. I was the one who needed encouragement to do the right thing, to really love my family. She said she understood, but her disappointment and hurt were obvious. She packed her books and headed for school. I also headed for school, God's school of spiritual lessons. First, self-justifying thoughts began racing through my mind. Surely she knows I love her. I've been there at other times. She knows I am a minister and must serve God's people. She will do just fine without me. But then my own voice from past sermons echoed, "Put your family first. If the family is to survive, fathers must make the family their number one priority. Dad is the most important person in a teenage girl's life." I was overwhelmed. In tears, I fell down on my knees and repented to God. I also thanked Him for refocusing my priorities toward my family. I got up and rearranged my appointments and, with great joy, looked forward to being with my daughter. The ecstasy. When I arrived at the track meet, I spotted my daughter standing across the field. She seemed a little down. She probably wondered why other people were more important to me. My mind flashed back to the times when I comforted her as a baby. I would rock her in my arms. I thought about the times I comforted her as a toddler when she fell and bumped her head. I thought about now when I would comfort her as a blossoming young woman by being by her side. I called her name. Surprised, she looked up. Her eyes met mine, and our agony was turned to ecstasy. Now she knew I truly loved her. Now she was sure the family was indeed my number one priority. She did not win any gold medals that day, but she won first place in the heart of her dad, and that's better than gold. By the way, God's work was done that day. How, you ask? The great God commissions fathers to turn their hearts to their children, Malachi 4:6. Fathers, do God's work. Give your heart, your time, and your life to your children. More than one other girl on my daughter's track team said, "Wow, your dad must really love you. My dad was too busy to take time off to see me run." In spite of my initial blindness, God used that day to convey to students and teachers a foretaste of the deep bond of love all parents and children will share in tomorrow's world. Who are the most important people in your life? If it's your family, don't be too busy to love them. Give them your life. Give them your time.
This completes tape number one, side number two of Love, Marriage, and Sex. Please continue on tape number two.